Further discussion. Senator from the 5th, what purpose do you rise?
Inquire of the senator from Buchanan.
Senator from the 10th is not on the floor. Senator from the 10th is not here. Sergeant at Arms, would you please summons the senator from the 10th? Would you please summon the senator from the 10th? But if you do it twice, then that would be summons, plural.
I didn't say, Mr. President, I'm sorry. I think you got it wrong. I would like to inquire of the senator from Buchanan.
Senator from?
That's the 34.
Senator from Buchanan. Okay, Senator from Buchanan. Senator from Buchanan is not on the floor. Sergeant at Arms, would you please summon the senator from Buchanan? Senator from Buchanan, the senator from the 5th has asked for an inquiry. Do you yield?
Yes.
He does proceed.
Thank you, Senator. I'll be extremely brief. I know you're busy negotiating.
I know. I'm just deep in
a well-deserved compromise. So earlier we were talking about the Supreme Court ruling. And as you well know, the Supreme Court decided to award $1.45 million in non-economical damages. Did you know that?
I think it was, what, a 4-3 decision?
Yeah, it was. But I'm asking you, did you know that that was the award?
Oh, I don't remember that, but thank you for telling me.
What? How about we just take the decision from the ruling and make that the cap?
Well, but the
what would be wrong with that?
The $1.4 million, was that all non-economic damages?
Yes.
Well, they ruled that there wouldn't be a cap. I mean, if we make that the cap, then you can expect to be losing physicians from Missouri because they'll go to Kansas. In the city of Kansas City, why would the doctors want to work in Missouri if they could go across the river and have a cap that lowers their medical malpractice insurance costs by, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars? I mean, it makes Missouri non-competitive. And in St. Louis, you'll be having the same thing. They'll go to Illinois. Why would they want to practice in St. Louis?
Senator, is that just a hypothetical?
No, it's absolutely not a hypothetical.
Senator, how many states do we have?
Talk to a neurosurgeon in the Kansas City area and ask them why they have opened their office in Overland Park. Call them and ask them. Go down to Joplin and talk to the senator from Newton. Inquire of him and ask him about the doctors that had built facilities in Kansas just down the road from Joplin and why they're doing that. Talk to him.
So how many states as of today that you know of has no non-economical damages caps?
I haven't done the study. I couldn't tell you. I don't know.
And many of them, and maybe I can find it on the internet, but many of those states, I haven't heard of any doctors going out of business as a result of non-economical damages. I mean, you have Alabama.
Well, they might not have gone out of business, but they just went into business instead of in Kansas City. They went over to the border of Kansas. I mean, instead of being in Joplin, they just went over into Kansas. I mean, doctors not going to go out of business because their costs go up. They're just going to move to a place where it's cheaper. I mean, that's...
Well, I mean, I don't know of any stories. I haven't heard of any stories, not in Alabama, where they have a non-economical damages. It's unconstitutional there to place caps on there on the non-damages. Arizona, I haven't heard of any stories where individuals fleed the state because of the unlimited caps.
Well, you wouldn't be in a
Arkansas,
position.
I haven't found anywhere in Arkansas where doctors have decided to just bail out because of because they don't have caps there.
See, I don't think either one of us would be in a position to hear those stories, but I can tell you
I've searched them, and I haven't seen anywhere where about There was horror stories where individuals like Arkansas and Georgia and Illinois and Kentucky and New Hampshire and Alabama, all of those different states, who had found it to be unconstitutional to place caps.
Okay, well let me ask you.
Those individuals did not impact the doctor's ability to perform. In those different states.
Okay, well, let me ask you this here. Imagine that you're a resident who's just coming out of training in neurosurgery, and you have to decide where to apply. Are you going to apply to those states, or are you going to apply to a state where you can get medical malpractice insurance for, say, $30,000 less?
Well, Senator, we're not going to legislate on hypotheticals.
No,
basically,
it's
true. What I'm saying
not hypothetical. This is
that
the
is
real
a hypothetical.
Truth.
You said what if? That's a hypothetical.
No, it's not.
It's a hypothetical.
Call and talk to them and ask them, where are you going? Talk to some of the neurosurgery groups in Missouri and ask them how much trouble they're having recruiting people to come to Missouri.
Again, where there are where we've found states that basically makes capping unconstitutional, those doctors are not fleeing those states. And again, Alabama, Arizona, Arkansas, Georgia, Illinois, Kentucky, they're not fleeing the states because there aren't any caps, huh?
As I told you, that. You are telling me the truth that those states don't have caps, I'm sure. But that doesn't help the problem that we've got.
Oh, so let me just ask you another question.
Three senators standing. Senator from Nottoway, for what purpose do you rise?
Thank you, Mr. President. Being the hour once again, I would ask the amendment to the amendment be returned. And, Mr. President, I have an amendment.
Madam Secretary, please send the amendment back. And Senator, please have your amendment sent forward.
It is, I believe, being distributed by our very capable, competent, and well-dressed doorman. I would request a waiver of the reading, and I would move for its adoption.
Thank you. Senator, would you care to explain?
I would very much like to explain it, and then I would allow the senator from the 5th to continue her dialogue with the senator from Buchanan. What this simple amendment does... keeping with my word and my commitment and my dedication to this body, it once again, after another hour of insightful debate on this floor, has reduced the cap another $50,000. We are now down to $300,000 for non-economic damages, irrespective of the number of defendants. With that, Mr. President, I move for the adoption, and if there is no debate, I'm happy to close.
The Senator from Holt moves the adoption of Senate Amendment Number 1 to Senate Amendment Number 2 to Senate Amendment Number 1. Does any senator desire to be heard on that motion? It is Senate Amendment Number 1 to Senate Amendment Number 2. Does any senator desire to be heard on that motion? Senator from the 5th, what purpose do you rise?
I would respectfully like to inquire the handler of the amendment.
That would be the Senator from DeKalb. Senator, do you yield? Senator from Gentry, do you yield?
I do, Mr. President.
He does. Proceed.
Senator, you know, I am a little appalled by your tactics here. Seems to me you think that this is a joke.
Nope. What I believe
I mean, you're constantly reducing.
I set out 500 with a commitment that the sooner we got this resolved, the better it was for everyone.
So, Senator, why are you constantly offering amendments that reduces the cap? I'm sure you have had the opportunity to read the Supreme Court ruling, right?
Yes, that's why I believe this needs to be on the ballot.
And you know that this here, why we're dealing with this today is a direct correlation to what happened with the Supreme Court ruling with the Cox versus with Nathan, where, you know, he found himself brain dead for life,
right?
And you keep coming to the floor as if it's a joke when you have a little baby that is brain dead for the rest of his life, and you're continuing to play with the value of that particular injury.
Nope, because we're ultimately going to get to a point, to a level, Senator, where many of the other states around us are. For example, Kansas is at $250,000, which means a couple more hours and we'll be there. Another hour and we'll be there. And I would imagine that when we get to that level, I would imagine that we stop. But I believe, Senator, that this should have been resolved 4 or 5 hours ago at $500,000, and we would be at a point where we were done, and we'd all be going home, and this would be behind us. But
if a person loses,
don't want to do that, and so therefore that we ratchet down. The longer they want to drag it out, we're just going to keep ratcheting.
But you're just playing around here.
Nope, I'm just saying that. Hey, I put forth my proposal, and when there's no counter proposal, we just keep lowering it each time. So
you think it's okay to the amendment where it is as it stands now? You think it's okay for that cap to be where it is when a person would have probably lost his limbs as a result of medical malpractice?
Here's what I think, Senator. I think that there are other states that are already at levels lower than this that function every day. And you know what? I think that at the end, do I believe that the cap will be at 250 or 300? I don't. But I also believe that right now, this unlimited world that we are operating in, not because of public policy set by this body, but because of activist judges, is not right either.
But we're not the only state that has unlimited caps. It's not like, you know, we're the lone lost sheep here. I mean, we have states throughout the states with unlimited caps, and it seems to be working. I mean, there isn't, you know, any stories that I have been able to find or stories that I've heard that basically stated that because they're not capped, that individuals, doctors are fleeing of the states.
That is a fallacy. I know firsthand of doctors in Kansas City that used to be in Kansas City, Missouri, that because of insurance premiums and risk have relocated their clinics into Kansas City, Kansas. So what's it mean from a delivery of care for the people in Kansas City? They drive an extra 5 blocks. So you know what? You're right. They can still get care, but they're getting it in Kansas City, Kansas versus Kansas City, Missouri. And why? Because of the legal climate. In fact, you know, last summer, Senator, I should find this article. There's a great article in Lawyers Weekly, if I remember right. I need to go back and find it. I think I actually have it somewhere. There was a law firm that was based in Kansas City, Kansas, that moved to Kansas City, Missouri. And in the article where they talked about moving, the reason they gave for moving is because that the laws in Kansas protect doctors, and in Missouri, it's a lot easier to sue people. That is the reason the law firm gave for moving. Like, that to me,
Senator,
that underscores that there's a problem.
Senator, why can't jurors, because basically what you'll be doing at this point is taking away the jury's decision to be able to decide
on non-economic damages.
Right. So right. You're moving away from, and they talked a lot about that, the rights of the juror a trial by juror. So basically, you're doing away with the rights of trial by juror with non-economical damages.
No, what I'm trying to figure out, Senator, is I'm trying to figure out where's the balance. Where's the balance between the jury's ability to make a award and balance that with the reality of when the potential risk is too high, you lose providers.
Okay, I understand your argument there. However, the question that I'm asking you, the question that I am asking you, as a result of capping, putting a cap on non-economical damages, would that then make rights of trial by jury absolute?
No.
With non-economical damages. Because now the legislators are deciding at that point if, I mean,
what the maximum would be. They could do anywhere in between.
So why can't we just allow the jurors to assess damages on a case-by-case basis?
I mean, I think that would be fair. You know, I mean, if we can do it on a case-by-case basis, what would be wrong with that?
Well, I think for true economic damages, for true cost, I think you're right. In fact, I have no issue with there being I have no problem with it being a jury trial. I have no problem that if an individual, if there's an actual dollar amount that's quantified, that true economic damages, that's fine. But what you can't have is you can't have an environment where the ability to sue is limitless, because at some point you won't have providers, because as you know, in life, when you're a business owner, you buy insurance to mitigate risk. And if you can't get insurance, or the cost of having that insurance is so exorbitant, there becomes a business decision where you make a decision that you no longer want to practice in that state. And right or wrong, Senator, and we can debate, we probably have different views on this, right or wrong, I believe that our citizens are detrimentally impacted when we do not have the opportunity for the quality of care that other citizens in other states do. And the reality is states like Kansas, through different mechanisms, have created an environment where they limit a doctor's risk, therefore dramatically drive down the cost of their premiums, which therefore mitigates the cost of the cost to the doctor, but yet ensures that doctors are there. So it's a delicate balance. I'm not saying that any one state has it perfect, Senator, but what I do believe is the way we are today, I do not believe we are balanced in a reasonable manner.
So what states right now actually hold limits on non-economical damages? What states are out there? And
I don't have the list right here in front of me. I know the senator from Buchanan had it. You might want to inquire of him. He had a list earlier that had a bunch of that information on it, and he might know it off the top of his head.
Okay. So again, I'm still trying to figure out and then I'll inquire of someone else.
You're fine.
I'm still trying to figure out how will capping non-economical damages impact the right to trial by jury?
I do not believe that capping the damages impacts your right to a trial by jury. What I will concede, Senator, is that by capping non-economic damages, you do limit what the jury has the ability to award.
So would that be, see, the Constitution, right, gives us that authority to go trial, rights by trial. Isn't that true to say?
Trial by jury.
Yeah, trial by jury.
Yeah. The courts in recent years have said that now they have mysteriously found in the last few years, even though we hadn't found it since 1821, that our Constitution guarantees a right to trial by jury. I don't think any of us would disagree that that is a good practice.
Okay.
So.
All right.
Again, the senator from Buchanan has a lot of that information you were talking about. You might want to inquire of him again.
Yeah, that's who I'm going to inquire.
Okay. Good enough. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator
from the 5th.
Or the senator from Buchanan.
From Buchanan. The senator from Buchanan is not here. The sergeant at arms will summon the senator from Buchanan here.
Excuse me, Mr. President.
Senator from the 5th.
I would respectfully like to inquire the senator from the 1st.
Senator from the 1st, do you yield?
I do.
He does. Proceed.
I just have a couple of terminologies that I found be fascinating that I don't know.
Sure.
Even the definitions of it. So tell me this here. Collateral source rule.
Uh-huh. The collateral source rule is a legal doctrine that I have litigated maybe once or twice in my career, if that. It pertains to a situation where A plaintiff claiming an injury has made, I'm going to try to explain it accurately, it has to deal with a situation where they have, where there's insurance coverage in question, and the fact that an injured plaintiff, for instance, might have had health care costs and might have had those health care costs paid by a health insurer, the defendant can't say, and therefore you shouldn't make them whole. And I'm probably not doing the best possible job of explaining that because it's been a little while since I've litigated it. There is also a separate collateral source.
I know that is connected to non-collateral damages, and that was the first time that I've ever heard of the collateral source rule.
Yeah, there's actually a separate collateral source doctrine as well, which basically holds that you can't have a double recovery in both tort and contract. The standard case is, let's just say you go to Radio Shack and you buy, I don't know, what would you buy at Radio Shack? A remote control car. And you buy the remote control car and it's broken. And you can't go back to the vendor and, you know, get your contractual remedy, which is give me my money back, the thing you sold me was broken, and also make a tort claim such as fraud or injury to the item itself. But I probably didn't explain that as well as I could either. But the collateral source rule, and I'm just pulling from a treatise here, prohibits admission of evidence that a victim's damages were or will be compensated from some source other than the damages award against the defendant. Insurance being the classic case, and in the practice of law, we call insurance the I word, and there are a whole lot of circumstances under which you can mention insurance and it can result in mistrial or otherwise be inadmissible. And so you're very careful in talking about whether a party has insurance, either paying, particularly compensating the plaintiff, but you're also careful about it if the defendants are insured for a host of different reasons. And I actually had a witness do this to me in a trial last year where I asked a question that did not prompt him to mention the fact that he was insured in the case, and he voluntarily offered that. And there was really nothing I could do at that point. I was, you know, that was the question, that was the answer. The jury heard it, and that's what happens sometimes. Which is why, generally, if you're ever a witness under oath, it's a really good idea to answer the question you are asked, and not the question that you wish you had been asked, or think the lawyer might really want to know but if only they'd phrase it correctly. It's just best to ask the question, answer the question asked.
Yeah, it's another terminology that's connected to the whole non-economical damages, and that's subrogation. Right?
Right. Subrogation. Yes. And
well, how does that?
Similar concept. We'll use somebody that's experienced a physical injury. And they have health insurance, and they go to the hospital, and they get their health care at the hospital, and that is paid by their health insurer. So the health insurer is a collateral source. The defendant can't say that they have health insurance, therefore I shouldn't have to pay. When that happens, and the result is that there is a damage award against the defendant for health care costs that were paid by the insurer, plaintiff gets a judgment against the defendant, but the health insurer who already paid out the damages that now the defendant has been ordered to pay the plaintiff is subrogated to the plaintiff's award against the defendant. So if let's just say you have $10,000 in medical costs. You're the injured plaintiff. I'm the defendant. The senator from the 13th is the insurer. You sue me, and she pays your $10,000 in medical costs. You sue me. I can't mention that she has paid the $10,000 in costs. You're able to introduce evidence of what those costs were, but you get a judgment against me for those $10,000 in costs. And if I were to then write you a $10,000 check and you keep it, you would have had your health care costs paid for by the senator from the 13th and paid by me. That would be a double recovery for you. So what we say is that the insurer, in this case the senator from the 13th, would be subrogated to your rights under the judgment. And in effect, what would happen is she would be reimbursed rather than you because you received the services. She's the one who's out of pocket having had to provide them. So in essence, the damages that I've been awarded to be paid would go to her rather than to you because she is subrogated. That's what subrogation means.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I know.
I have the opportunity to find the states where non-economical damages are capped. Okay.
Yep.
And California is one, Colorado, Florida, Kansas City, Maryland, Massachusetts, Michigan, North Carolina, Texas. And I had someone to text someone to ask them if they can do some research to find out how many, as a result of the caps that's placed on non-economical damages, how many of those doctors stayed in the state with, you know, that had the caps?
Lots. Lots. At the margins, and I'll say, you know, in the Kansas City area, and the Center from the Seventh talks about this, where leaving the state involves crossing a street that doesn't look a whole lot different than Missouri Boulevard here in Jefferson City, you know, the reality is there is much greater mobility. We don't deal with that just in the healthcare and professional physician context. We deal with that in all kinds of economic development contexts where we worry about businesses crossing state lines in a way that doesn't help our state. And that is an issue, particularly in regions like that, where you have that kind of a major metropolitan area that spans state lines. So, you know, I would say that, you know, those, you know, it's neither extreme. It's not as though it has no effect, and it's not as though we'll never have another doctor work in Missouri if we fail to do this. I mean, there will, you know, that said, all things being equal, I do think it is a point in favor of having a reasonable cap on the books in Missouri that we do have to think about competition with neighboring states. After all, this side of Tennessee, we neighbor more states than any other state in the union.
So I'm going to sit down, and I really want to know what type of impact the caps will have on the right of trial by jurors. I can't wrap my head around it in terms of, you know, how would that impact that statute?
Sure.
Being that we're now taking it out of the court's hands, and we as legislators, we've decided to, and that's what the Supreme Court wanted us to do, but we've decided to put caps on, and if it's capped, it's capped, right?
Yep.
So rights to trial by jury would be obsolete. And that's what I think. I'm not an attorney, but maybe you can elaborate a little bit more on the court case and
sure.
and everything. I'll be reading it along the way, but thank you.
Senator, thank you. Mr. President.
Further discussion. Senator from the First, for what purpose do you rise?
The President to speak on the amendment to the amendment.
Proceed.
You know, we've been here 5.5 hours now since we reconvened in the afternoon, and this bill was on, well, not this SJR, House Bill 1773 was on the floor for some time this morning, and this has been one of those days in the Missouri Senate. We're standing here at only 8:30 in the evening. I honestly can't remember how long 1773 was on the floor for this morning. I wouldn't want to misrepresent it. It might have been half an hour. It might have been 2 hours. I just don't remember exactly what all happened this morning. Now that we've been at it for 5.5 hours here tonight. And I certainly recognize that there are and have been and will be many debates in the Missouri Senate where we spend a whole lot more than between 6 and 8 hours on one topic in a given day. And I will tell you that the approach that has been taken with amendments and continued cycling of withdrawing amendments and ratcheting down the cap number. I suppose I understand why somebody might try to do that in an effort to roll those who are trying to negotiate for something different. It is what it is. I'm unfazed by it. I don't think that it's terribly helpful to the process. I don't think that it creates the leverage that people think that it creates. And if anything, I have to tell you, it has only reinforced my resolve to continue this discussion because we need to get to a good place on this. And as the senator offering the amendment to the amendment proudly boasts, he has been, with each passing step, trying to get us to a worse and worse place as the evening has gone on. That happens. That is his right. That is what we have the procedural mechanisms of the Senate to do. And I respect that. I respect that. That said, I am inclined at this stage in the proceedings, now that we have been debating both 1776 and this SJR in good faith, while others have been talking about it outside the room, to do something that I have not yet ever felt the need to do on the floor of the Missouri Senate. And that's not to say that I haven't been close. We've been close a couple of times even this year. But I think at this point, before we discuss this issue any further, I think it is terribly important that the members of the body be mindful of the legal framework in which we find ourselves legislating. And there is no more authoritative, no more recent indication of the framework that we find ourselves in, Mr. President, than the decision handed down on July 31st, 2012, by the Missouri Supreme Court en banc in the case of Deborah Watts as next friend for Nathan Kane Watts, who was the appellant cross-respondent, versus Lester E. Cox Medical Centers, DBA Family Medical Care Center, and Lester E. Cox Medical Center's respondent, Melissa R. Herman, M.D., Matthew P. Green, D.O., and William S. Kelly, M.D., who in that case were the respondents and cross-appellants. Case was numbered SC-9, which is Supreme Court, 91867, decided July 31, 2012. A post-decision motion for rehearing was denied on September 25th, 2012, and the opinion of the court was modified on the court's own motion on the same date that it denied rehearing, and that date being September 25th, 2012. The background for the Watts case that was provided by the Supreme Court was simply that a mother, as the next friend of her child, who was born with catastrophic brain injuries, filed a medical negligence suit against the hospital and doctors, alleging that their negligence resulted in the child's injuries. Circuit Court of Greene County, the Honorable Dan J. Conklin presiding, after imposing a statutory cap on non-economic damages awarded to the mother, entered judgment on a jury verdict in favor of the mother. The mother appealed, and the hospital and doctors cross-appealed. That decision, the Supreme Court of Missouri, in an opinion authored by the Honorable Richard B. Titleman, at the time Chief Judge, held, first, statute imposing a cap on non-economic damages for medical negligence violates the right to jury trial set forth in our state's Constitution. And in so doing, the Supreme Court overruled the decision in Adams by and through Adams versus Children's Mercy Hospital, a decision, an opinion, that was published at 832 Southwest 2nd, 898. And the second holding of our state Supreme Court was that periodic payment schedule for payment by the hospital and doctors of future medical damages awarded to the mother was arbitrary and unreasonable. As a result, the court affirmed the lower court ruling in part, reversed it in part, and remanded the ruling back to the Circuit Court of Greene County. The Honorable Mary R. Russell, now the Chief Judge of the Missouri Supreme Court, then a judge of the Supreme Court, concurred in part and dissented in part with an opinion in which Judge Breckinridge and former Judge Price concurred. For the moment, I am not going to burden the body or members of the public who might be listening to this debate with the head notes that go with the case. However, I will reserve my right to do so at a later point in the proceedings this evening, should I feel the inclination. The case was briefed by Andre M. Mira from the Center for Constitutional Litigation in Washington, D.C., by Roger Johnson with the firm of Johnson, Voorhees, and Martucci in Joplin for the plaintiff, Ms. Watts. I will note, I believe that the Voorhees in that firm name is a law school classmate of mine from the University of Michigan Law School class of 1999. Hail to the victors valiant. The case was also briefed by Kent O. Hyde and David E. Overby of the law firm Hyde, Love, and Overby, LLP, in Springfield for Cox, and briefed by Jeremiah J. Morgan of the Missouri Office of Attorney General here in Jefferson City across the street in the Supreme Court building for the center and physicians. And I suspect the reason that the Missouri Attorney General's office got involved in the case is because it questioned the constitutionality of our state statute establishing a non-economic damages cap. The opinion itself provided as follows. Deborah Watts filed the underlying medical malpractice action alleging that her son, Nathan Watts, was born with disabling brain injuries because Cox Medical Centers and its associated physicians, collectively Cox, provided negligent health care services. The jury returned a verdict in favor of Watts and awarded $1.4 $5 million in non-economic damages and $3.371 million in future medical damages. This was a Greene County jury. The trial court entered a judgment reducing Watts' non-economic damages, and here I'm embellishing, from $1.45 million to $350,000, as required by Section 538.210, very statute that we've been debating here today. The judgment also established a periodic payment schedule pursuant to Section 538.220. Periodic payment schedule required immediate payment of half of all net future medical damages, with the other half paid in equal annual installments over the next 50 years with an interest rate of 0.26%. The court clarified in a note that all statutory references in its opinion are to statutes as set forth in the revised statutes of Missouri in the edition that was provided in the year 2000. Laws change from year to year, you know. Watts asserts, here the court's opinion provides, that Watts asserts that the Section 538.210 cap on non-economic damages violates the right to trial by jury and several other provisions of the Missouri Constitution. I note that the SJR that is before this body pertains to only one constitutional provision. Continuing with the court's opinion, Watts also asserts that the Section 538.220 periodic payment schedule was arbitrary and unreasonable, in that it does not assure full compensation due to the low interest rate and the 50-year payment schedule. The court, in another note, clarified on the nature of the other constitutional provisions that were challenged in the case, indicating that Watts asserted that Section 538.210 also violates the constitutional separation of powers, Article 2, Section 1, also violates equal protection, Article 1, Section 2, also violates the prohibition against special legislation, Article 3, Section 40, and the clear title and single subject requirements of Article 3, Section 23 of the Missouri Constitution. Court stated that because it found that Section 538.210 violates the right to trial by jury in Article 1, Section 22A, that the other challenges, the other constitutional challenges, need not be addressed. Court explained that Watts also asserted that Section 538.220 violates equal protection and the right to due process. And again, the court indicated that it need not reach those issues because, in its view, the trial court misapplied that statute being 538.220, and the court stated that it would not, therefore, reach the constitutional issues if the case can be decided on statutory grounds, which is frequently, in fact, always done by courts. The opinion went on to provide that Cox has filed a cross appeal asserting that the trial court erred in its immediate award of future medical damages. Cox asserts that Section 538.220 prohibits a lump sum payment of a portion of future medical damages and instead requires that all future medical damages be paid pursuant to a periodic payment schedule, regardless of when the need for the medical damage payments will arise. This court holds that Section 538.210 is unconstitutional to the extent that it infringes on the jury's constitutionally protected purpose of determining the amount of damages sustained by an injured party. Such a limitation was not permitted at common law when Missouri's Constitution first was adopted in 1820, and therefore violates the right to trial by jury guaranteed by Article 1, Section 22A of the Missouri Constitution. Accordingly, the judgment is reversed to the extent that it caps non-economic damages pursuant to Section 538.210. To the extent that the decision in Adams, by and through Adams, versus Children's Mercy Hospital, 832 Southwest 2nd, 898 at page 907, Missouri Supreme Court, en banc, 1992, is inconsistent with this decision, it is overruled. This court further holds that the trial court abused its discretion in entering a periodic payment schedule pursuant to Section 538.220 that did not assure full compensation due to the interest rate and 50-year payment schedule. Finally, and this is unfortunately not finally within the opinion, this is a finally in the summary of the holdings at the start of the opinion. Finally, this court holds that Section 538.220 gives the judge the authority to determine the manner in which future damages shall be paid, including what portion should be paid in future installments as to both medical and future damages. Cox's argument on cross appeal that all future damages must be paid in a lump sum is rejected. In all other respects, the judgment of the lower court is affirmed. The case is remanded. The first section of the opinion after the introduction recites the facts of the case. They are as follows. Cox provided prenatal care to Watts. On October 30th, 2006, when she was approximately 39 weeks pregnant. Watts went to a clinic associated with Cox because she was experiencing cramping and because she detected decreased fetal movement. Dr. Herman, who was then a third-year medical resident, examined Watts. The evidence at trial indicated that Dr. Herman did not perform appropriate tests, failed to notify Watts of the significance of decreased fetal movement, and failed to perform any further diagnostic monitoring. Dr. Herman's supervisor, Dr. Kelly, signed off on Dr. Herman's findings. On November 1, 2006, Watts was admitted to the hospital due to a lack of fetal movement. Watts was placed on a fetal monitor at 9:10 a.m. Watts expert Dr. Roberts testified that this diagnostic monitoring indicated fetal hypoxia and acidosis, and that the standard of care required immediate cesarean section delivery. Dr. Green, second year medical resident who was examining Watts, did not begin the cesarean section until 10:45 a.m. Nathan Watts was born with catastrophic brain injuries. Watts sued, and I'm going to start referring it to as the hospital. Watts sued the hospital, claiming that its doctor's malpractice caused Nathan's brain injuries. After trial, the jury returned a verdict in favor of Watts and awarded $1.45 million in non-economic damages and $3.371 million in future medical damages. The jury then reduced the future medical damages to present value pursuant to Section 538.220. The jury reduced the future damages at a rate of 4% per annum. The estimated yield on a safe long-term investment, at least for now, which worked out of a present value of $1,747,600. The hospital then requested that it be permitted to pay the future damages in periodic payments pursuant to Section 538.220. In response, the trial court entered a payment schedule under which half of the future damages would be paid immediately in a lump sum, and half would be paid over a 50-year period at the statutorily required interest rate of 0.26%. Second section of the court's opinion outlines the appropriate standard of review. The court ruled as follows. This court has exclusive jurisdiction over this appeal because it involves a challenge to the validity of a statute of this state. The court cites the Missouri Constitution, Article 5, Section 3. Watts' constitutional challenge to the validity of Section 538.210 is subject to de novo review. Here, the court cited the case of Rentschler v. Nixon, 311 Southwest 3rd, 783 at page 786 a ruling that was made by the Missouri Supreme Court en banc in 2010. A statute is presumed valid and will not be held unconstitutional unless it clearly contravenes a constitutional provision. Same side. Watts has the burden of proving that the statutes clearly and undoubtedly violate the Constitution. Watts' argument that the trial court erred by requiring one half of future medical damages to be paid pursuant to a section 538.220 periodic payment schedule is subject to review only on the basis of its arbitrariness. For that proposition, the court cited the case of Vincent versus Johnson, 833 Southwest 2nd, 859 at page 866, a decision of the Missouri Supreme Court sitting en banc in the year 1992. Appellate courts ask whether a circuit court abused its discretion in crafting a periodic payment schedule for future damages. Court cites DeVolt versus Highland, 119 Southwest 3rd, 118 at page 139. That was a ruling of the Missouri Court of Appeals in 2003. A trial court will be found to have abused its discretion when a ruling is clearly against the logic of the circumstances then before the court and is so arbitrary and unreasonable as to shock the sense of justice and indicate a lack of careful consideration. For that, the court cited the case of Klotz versus St. Anthony's Medical Center, 311 Southwest 3rd, 752 at page 760, that decision being handed down by the Missouri Supreme Court en banc in the year 2010. And that decision quoted the ruling in Swartz versus Gale Webb Transportation Company at 215 Southwest 3rd, 127, pages 129 through 130, a decision of the Missouri Supreme Court sitting en banc in the year 2007. The hospital's cross appeal asserts that section 538.220 requires all future medical damages to be paid according.
Senator from Andrew.
Thank you, Mr. President. It's not quite 9:10. So with that, I'd ask the bill be placed on the informal calendar.
The bill will be placed on the informal calendar. Senator from Newton.
President, without objection, the Senate will go to business of a report standing committees, and I have a report.
Reports from standing committees, please send your report forward. When it arrives, Madam Secretary, please read the report.
Mr. President, your Committee on Rules, Joint Rules, Resolutions, and Ethics, to which was referred Senate Substitute for Senate Committee Substitute for Senate Bill No. 774, begs leave to report that it has examined the same and finds that the bill has been truly perfected and that the printed copies furnished the senators are correct. Also, Mr. President, your Committee on Rules, Joint Rules, Resolutions, and Ethics, to which was referred Senate Substitute for Senate Committee Substitute for Senate Bill No. 706, begs leave to report that it has examined the same and finds that the bill has been truly perfected and that the printed copies furnished the senators are correct. Also, Mr. President, your Committee on Rules, Joint Rules, Resolutions, and Ethics, to which was referred Senate Substitute for Senate Bill No. 575, begs leave to report that it has examined the same and finds that the bill has been truly perfected and that the printed copies furnished the senators are correct. Also, Mr. President, your Committee on Rules, Joint Rules, Resolutions, and Ethics, to which was referred Senate Bill No. 890, begs leave to report that it has examined the same and finds that the bill has been truly perfected and that the printed copies furnished the senators are correct. Respectfully submitted, Senator Richard, Chairman.
Senator from 23rd, senior senator, only senator from St. Charles.
Thank you, Mr. President. Would you please send Senate Substitute for Senate Bill 575 to the Governmental Accountability and Fiscal Oversight Committee?
It will be so referred. Senator from Newton.
Mr. President, you call on me?
I did, Senator.
Thank you. Without objection, Senator, go to business announcements.
Announcements. Announcements? Seeing none, Senator. Senator from Newton.
Mr. President, don't put the business come to the body. I move the Senate stand adjourned under the rules.
You've heard the motion from the Senator from Newton. As many are of the opinion that motion shall prevail, say aye.
Aye.
To the contrary, say no. The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it. The Senate stands adjourned.